Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. The sun is shining, it's a beautiful day, and yet we're going to be talking about something extremely dark. There's some crazy statistic that says in the US there's something like 35 to 50 active serial killers at any given moment. And that's just a terrifying thought, because where are they? What are they doing? Why haven't we caught them? And I've also read that you'll walk past a murderer 36 times in your lifetime on average. Yeah, I'm looking at an article right now, and the question says, how many serial killers will you meet in your lifetime? Which is vastly different than just walking past someone, which is already terrifying. But the answer says, at 26.2 new people per day, the average American meets 717,225 people throughout their lives, of which 10.76 are likely to be unapprehended murderers. And also, okay, meeting 26.2 people per day, I think that is wrong. I don't meet that many people in a week. But also I work from home, so maybe that's on me. But that seems like a big number. Let's just say it's an overestimation, because that seems wrong to me. Because that makes me feel better, you know? I don't want to think that that's true. Even if it's only one in your lifetime, that's too many. But something that gives me a little peace of mind is that it seems like it's harder to be a murderer nowadays and, like, get away with it. I'm not saying people don't murder people. Obviously they do. But with, like, all the technology we have now, it's a lot better than how it was back in the day. Back in the day being, in this case, the 1970s and 80s, which were the prime time for serial killers in the US. But this story in particular is absolutely bone-chilling. This one sounds like a movie, and in fact, it was made into a movie because it's so over the top and cinematic in some kind of crazy messed up way. Robert Hansen, in every sense of the word, was like a true predator. Not just in that he was killing women, but in that he took pleasure in stalking and literally hunting these women. And what's so crazy is that for a man so dangerous and terrible, by day, he was what seemed to be an innocent baker, a family man, a businessman in the community that people enjoyed. So it really is just that major stereotype of, like, a wolf in sheep's clothing. But we will get into that more specifically in the story, so why don't we just get started? On August 13th, 1982, two off-duty police officers were hunting moose in the Alaskan wilderness near the Knik River, about 20 miles away from Anchorage. But as they made their way through the forest, they stumbled upon partially buried human remains. Knowing the procedure for this kind of thing, they left it undisturbed and called it in. The next day, crime scene technicians from the Alaska State Troopers arrived at the scene, since crimes out in the wilderness fell into state jurisdiction. Besides clothing and an elastic bandage, state troopers found a .223 caliber shell casing in the shallow grave. They also found bullet wounds on the body which weren't reflected in the clothing, which meant whoever had done this had dressed the body after death. Dental records identified the remains of 23-year-old Sherry Morrow. She was an exotic dancer who had been reported missing a year earlier by her boyfriend. The clothes found on the body at the scene matched the description of Sherry her boyfriend had given to police a year earlier. The only thing missing was her gold arrowhead necklace, which she never took off because it was her good luck charm. They determined that Sherry had probably been murdered very soon after she initially disappeared, which wasn't great for the investigation because it had given her killer a whole year to cover their tracks, meaning finding whoever had committed her murder would be next to impossible. In the year following Sherry Morrow's murder, more women's bodies began turning up in the surrounding area. However, it isn't that uncommon to find bodies out in the Alaskan wilderness. Two or three times a year, a hunter or hiker would go missing and succumb to the elements. But during a road construction on September 2nd, 1983, a crew unearthed human skeletal remains not far from where Sherry Morrow's body had been found just a year earlier. The bones had obviously been there for a long time. However, until recently, that area of the Kinnick River was so remote, it could only be accessed by boat or small plane. The remains were identified as 17-year-old Paula Goulding. She had previously worked as a secretary and moved to Alaska from Hawaii and had been missing for 5 months. After moving to Alaska, she had taken a job as an exotic dancer to make ends meet. And like Sherry Morrow, a .223 caliber cartridge was found at the scene, and the bullet wounds were in her body, but not in her clothes. It was in that moment that the Alaska State Trooper, Wayne Van Claussen, believed the two deaths may have been connected. The similarities between the two were frightening. Both women had been exotic dancers from the clubs downtown. They were found in this highly remote area, with shell casings from what looked to be the same gun. It was highly likely that they were dealing with a serial murderer. At that point, only the two bodies had been found, but troopers believed that there would be more. This was when they began looking back at old missing persons reports. They found that many of the women who had been reported missing were also exotic dancers. However, in Alaska, a disappearance like that was not uncommon. From what the trooper said, an adult missing persons case was a relatively low priority. Because if you're an adult, you have the right to be missing, which is something we've talked about in previous cases. That can be a huge problem for actual missing persons cases. If an adult goes missing, the investigation into that is going to be very small, if not pretty non-existent in some cases, because as an adult, you have the right to come and go as you please. And I understand that that's like fair in some regard, but there have definitely been cases where adults who have gone missing situations have only gotten worse because of the low priority of their cases, and then they're stuck in the situation they're in because police aren't looking into it like they should. For instance, on Patreon, we told a story about a woman, Tanya Ryder, who disappeared and she was reported missing by her boyfriend, and she was missing for, I think, 8 days. And the police just did not believe her boyfriend and told him that either she had just left him or they believed that the boyfriend was responsible for her disappearance and they started looking into him as a suspect for her murder. Meanwhile, she had gotten into a car accident and was sitting at the bottom of a ditch for 8 days. Thankfully, she was found alive, but she was really close to death when that happened. So there are instances where adults having the right to go missing is a bad thing. But there had been instances where women who were reported missing had just left the Anchorage area. Between 1980 and 1983, 12 women had been reported missing, and that was only a fraction of the unreported total. So troopers began wondering how many of these missing women had become victims of this potential killer. The Alaska State Trooper sent the evidence from the Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding crime scenes to the FBI lab in Washington, D.C. for analysis. One of the first things they did was run a ballistics test on the shell casings to see if they had been shot from the same gun. And they were really hoping it would come back to be the same, because that would give them strong evidence that the same person had committed both murders. And the lab results were conclusive. Both women were killed by the same high-powered rifle. There was very little doubt at that point that they were dealing with a serial killer. Robert Hansen was born in Estherville, Iowa, on February 15, 1939. He was the eldest of two children to an American mother, Edna Margaret Hansen, and Danish father and local baker, Christian Hansen. In his youth, Robert Hansen was painfully shy. He had a stutter and suffered from severe acne that left him permanently scarred. Throughout childhood and adolescence, he was described as a quiet loner who had a difficult relationship with his domineering father. He grew up as an awkward, shy boy, and he didn't have many friends and was bullied throughout his schooling. The girls in school were also never interested in him, which he was very resentful of. His parents owned a bakery, so when he wasn't at school, his father was making him work very long hours in the bakery, and he paid him 25 cents to a dollar a week, which is crazy. And when he wasn't working, he spent his time alone, taking up hobbies like fishing and hunting. He got a real thrill from stalking his prey, and when he killed the animal, he enjoyed the satisfaction of taking the animal's life, but more than anything, he enjoyed the chase. Hansen started to practice both hunting and archery, often finding refuge in those pastimes. In 1957, he enlisted in the United States Army Reserve and served for 1 year before being discharged. He later worked as an assistant drill instructor at a police academy in Pocahontas. There, he began a relationship with a younger woman whom he married in the summer of 1960. On December 7th of 1960, Hansen was arrested for burning down a Pocahontas County school bus garage as revenge for his unpopularity in high school. He was bullied, and girls didn't like him, so he burnt down the bus garage. And for that, he served 20 months of a 3-year prison sentence in the state penitentiary. During his incarceration, he was diagnosed with manic depression with periodic schizophrenic episodes. The psychiatrist who made the diagnosis noted that Hansen had an infantile personality and was obsessed with getting back at people he felt had wronged him. Hansen's wife, unsurprisingly, filed for divorce while he was incarcerated. Over the next few years, Hansen was jailed several times for petty theft. In 1967, he moved to Anchorage, Alaska, with his second wife, whom he married in 1963, and he had 2 children with. In Anchorage, he was well-liked by his neighbors and set several local hunting records. His weapons of choice were either a rifle or a bow and arrow. He was really into archery, and not only did he set records in hunting, but some of his kills were featured in hunting publications. Not long after his move to Anchorage, young women began disappearing in and around the area, but police wouldn't connect the dots for those disappearances for many years. On December 22nd of 1971, 18-year-old Beth Van Zanten was kidnapped while she was hitchhiking. She had been trying to get to a local convenience store when she was picked up by Robert Hansen. One of the most tragic parts of her disappearance was she actually had managed to escape her abductor, but froze to death in the wilderness after falling down into a ravine. Absolutely heartbreaking. Around the same time of Beth being discovered, Robert Hansen's behavior was escalating. He was arrested twice for, first, abducting a secretary at gunpoint, and then for the abduction and rape of an 18-year-old sex worker, Sandra Patterson. He took her to a similar area where Beth's body had been found. He stripped her, and like Beth, both of the girls were in their teens. It was almost identical to the girl who had just been found dead. But despite the seriousness, because of plea deals, Hansen was sentenced to 5 years, but only ended up serving 6 months of that sentence. 5 years for that is already a ridiculous thing, but the fact that he served 6 months is like a slap in the face. He pleaded no contest to assault with a deadly weapon in the former offense. The rape charge involving the sex worker was dropped as a part of a plea bargain. So after those 6 months, he was placed on a work release and was sent to live in a halfway house. So he was released. In 1976, Hansen pled guilty to larceny after he was caught stealing a chainsaw from an Anchorage Fred Meyer store. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison, and after claiming he had memory lapses, he was required to receive psychiatric treatment. The Alaska Supreme Court reduced his sentence, and he was released with time served. And his criminal career only continued. He filed false insurance claims saying someone had stolen things from his home, but when they later looked into this crime, his missing hunting trophies were found in his possession. But he actually did get money from the insurance company for these quote-unquote stolen items, and through the insurance payout, he was able to open his very own bakery. He must have been filing a lot of false insurance claims, because in January of 1982, he bought himself a small plane. A Super Cub Piper, which is a 2-seat, single-engine, motorplane aircraft. At this time in his life, despite his past with crime, he became a quite popular figure in the community. He was a local businessman, a family man, and was able to blend into society. He came to be known as Bob the Baker. No one had any idea who this guy actually was. He was a serial killer with a long-standing hatred of women, and he took it out on sex workers. He felt justified in killing sex workers because in his mind, they were unworthy of life. From a very young age, Robert Hansen had an extreme hatred of women. If incels were a thing at the time, Robert Hansen would have been an incel. And for those who don't know what that means, incel is a portmanteau of involuntarily celibate. In its most basic form, incel describes someone, usually a male, who is frustrated by their lack of sexual experience, and is defined as heterosexual men who blame women and society for their lack of romantic success. So later in his life, he did have a wife and children, but earlier in his life, women were not interested in him, and that caused a lot of hatred toward them. It really makes you wonder how he was able to have any kind of relationship, but I guess since he was trying to have a life of crime, he was really trying to blend in and seem as unassuming as possible. In the 1970s and 1980s, people flocked to Alaska. Specifically, construction workers came to the area because of the projects that were available, like the Alaskan pipeline, and that resulted in good pay. And because of that, there was also a very active nightlife scene. There was a lot of sex work going on. And although Alaska is the biggest state in the country, it is the least densely populated, with only one person per square mile, which makes it an attractive place if you want to be left alone, or if you enjoy the rugged wilderness, like hunting and fishing is a very common thing up there. For Hansen, he had the perfect hunting ground. He knew that sex workers in general were harder to track down and would be easy targets for him. On June 14, 1983, police got a call from a trucker who had picked up a woman who was found barefoot and handcuffed, running along the side of the road. The trucker had taken her to a hotel at her request and then called the police. When the Anchorage police got there, Officer Greg Baker recalled they found her with the handcuffs still on her, and she was in very little clothing. An officer removed her handcuffs and attempted to calm her down, since she was still incredibly shaken by her experience. According to Officer Baker, Cindy Paulson was extremely credible. She seemed to be genuine in what she told the police, and overall, she seemed really scared. 18-year-old Cindy Paulson was a sex worker in Anchorage, Alaska, and the night prior, Robert Hansen stopped her as she was leaving the strip club and offered her $200 to perform oral sex. She described Hansen to be a wiry, scruffy man, about 6 feet tall, with glasses and a stutter. When she first saw him, he didn't strike her as a threatening person. But as soon as she stepped into his car, he handcuffed her to the door and put a wood-handled revolver to her head. They drove to one of the nicer residential neighborhoods in the area, and after pulling into Hansen's driveway, he dragged Cindy, who was still handcuffed, into his house. The place was well-kept and full of hunting trophies and stuffed heads of many different animals on the walls. When he walked her into the living room, she saw a chain hanging from the ceiling, which he locked her to after stripping her. There she was tortured and raped for the next few hours. After a terrifying night, Hansen told Cindy they would hop on his small plane and go to a cabin in the woods. He told her he wouldn't hurt her, and it was okay because he'd taken 7 other women there before. He told her he'd make love to her there, and then he would take her home. She should be home by around 11 o'clock. And so Cindy decided to act like she was interested. But after that, he told her if she tried to get anyone's attention or tried to escape, he would kill her and any person she interacted with. He also told her that he already had his alibi worked out with a friend who was willing to lie for him, and nobody would believe her story anyway because she was 18 years old and a sex worker. Cindy knew before that moment that he was planning to kill her out there, but that just confirmed it. After driving for a while, they ended up at the airport where Hansen left her in the car as he readied his small plane. As she watched him load a gun into the plane, she knew if she got onto that plane and went with him, she would never be going home. And although she was still handcuffed and wrapped in a blanket in the back seat, this would be her only opportunity to escape. She threw the back car door open and ran as fast as she could away from Hansen. Not long into her sprint, she managed to flag down a passing car with a man inside who thankfully stopped for her. And that was what she told police. And her story seemed very legit. Based off of her profession, Officer Baker knew that Cindy Paulson would have been very street smart, but she was petrified after telling this story. She had described Hansen's home in great detail. She gave them a specific location along with as much information as she could remember about the layout of his home and what they would find inside of it, because at this point she didn't know her abductor's name. But she did give them all the information she could possibly remember, and it was a lot. She described the den and told officers about the specific animal heads which were mounted on the walls, and she told them where his plane was. And before she was even taken to the hospital for examination, the police drove her back to the airport since she insisted on showing them, and she was able to point out Hansen's small plane. While the officers and Paulson were in the hangar, a security guard approached them and was also able to describe Hansen's car, which was the same way that Cindy had described it to them, and he had even given them a license plate number. Through that, police were able to identify Robert Hansen pretty quickly. And when they looked up his address, his home was in the area that Paulson had told them it would be. After bringing Cindy to the hospital, police went to Hansen's home to see if they could speak with him. And they arrived only moments before he pulled up. He had been driving the car that Cindy Paulson had described, so far, everything she had told the police had been checking out. But of course, Robert Hansen would have a different story. Hansen, as we know, was the local baker. He fit the description for the man who had abducted Cindy Paulson, however, he was extremely unassuming. He led police into his house and calmly answered their questions. During this interview, he gave police his alibi, claiming that he was at a friend's house from 5 p.m. to 11:30 p.m., repairing a seat for his airplane. And afterward, he went to the home of another friend and stayed there until about 5:30 the next morning. After that, he went to the airport and installed the seat he had repaired. And as we know, he told Cindy that he had a friend who was willing to lie for him about his alibi, so that was going to check out for him. And on top of that, he even let police search his home voluntarily. Again, his house was exactly as Paulson had described, down to each of the animal heads that they saw on the walls. However, that only proved that she had been inside his house, not that he had tortured and raped her. After looking through his house, police found no evidence of foul play. The chain was nowhere to be found, and although they found some guns behind a loose-fitting wall panel, they didn't find the wood-handled revolver that Paulson had described. They had found a revolver, but it was different from what Cindy had said, and the guns weren't a surprise to police because Robert Hansen's house was full of hunting trophies. When police looked in Hansen's car, it also looked clean. They found nothing in his car that fit Cindy's story. So since he had consented to a search and police found nothing, and his alibi was confirmed, he was released. Cindy Paulson, who was still shaken from everything, was brought into the station and was able to pick Hansen out of a lineup. But when she was asked to give a lie detector test, she refused. Given her profession, it's no surprise she had an inherent distrust of the police, which also made police distrust her. Her concern was that she wouldn't be taken seriously, and if for whatever reason she failed the polygraph test, she would get in trouble herself. And she wasn't that crazy to feel that way, because there were definitely officers who didn't believe her story. And Cindy's life after Hansen hadn't been much better. The fear she had experienced that night, and how close she had been to death, rarely left her. She had a tough life to begin with. She had run away from home at the age of 12, and not long after that met her first pimp. In the months following the attack, her life spiraled. Her pimp had her working in a really awful after-hours club, and police caught wind that her pimp had received a half-pound shipment of cocaine, and the last thing they needed was their best witness caught up in a coke bust. So after all the questioning was done, Cindy left town to try to put everything behind her. Anchorage police were also willing to put the whole thing behind them. Since Hansen's alibi worked out and since they had some problems with Cindy Paulson disappearing and reappearing, along with her line of work, the case was suspended. But thankfully, Officer Greg Baker wasn't finished with Cindy Paulson's case. He was one of the few officers who believed Cindy's story and didn't want to let it go. Robert Hansen, as we know, had been released due to lack of evidence, but Officer Baker continued to look into him since he was their most likely suspect. He also began looking into the numerous missing persons reports since there seemed to be an uptick in them, especially in sex workers, strippers, or women who went out by themselves. Not only had Cindy Paulson's story completely lined up, but she reported she was about to be put on a plane, and that fact confirmed Baker's suspicion that Robert Hansen could be the person behind a lot of these missing women. He knew about the bodies that had been found out in the Alaskan wilderness, and although it wasn't in his jurisdiction, it was for the state troopers, he had a bit of suspicion that this was all connected. On the surface, Baker found nothing about Robert Hansen to arouse suspicion. He had moved from Iowa to Anchorage a few years prior and opened up a highly successful bakery. He had a wife and children, and aside from his stutter, he fit in. Frank Rothschild, who was the prosecutor involved with the case, said that the state troopers and the police used to go to Robert Hansen's bakery to get their donuts all the time. It was a very popular place to go, and Robert, or Bob the Baker, seemed like a friendly, hard-working guy. He didn't seem to fit the mold of serial killer. There were plenty of other shady characters in Anchorage with nothing to lose who would have seemed a lot more likely in this situation, but Hansen did have a lot to lose. Which I'm sure contributed to the fact that most of the police found it very easy to let the case go. State troopers, who were unaware of Greg Baker's investigation into Robert Hansen, were still trying to find their serial killer. Because, like I said, these were two separate investigations. And the troopers continued to unearth bodies out in the wilderness outside of Anchorage. They had also set up a task force to look into the similarities between the murder victims. Until authorities knew more, they did their best to spread the word amongst dancers and sex workers in the area, to give them some warning and tell them to play it safe and keep an eye out for the maniac who was killing people. It's a rare occurrence when police and sex workers were on the same side. It didn't take long before Officer Baker unearthed Robert Hansen's criminal background, which was when he learned that Hansen had already been arrested for kidnapping, rape, and assault with a deadly weapon, which were extremely similar to what Cindy Paulson had described. The issue was, Baker couldn't bring this information to his supervisor because he wasn't supposed to be working on it at all. He had no alternative but to gather as much evidence as he possibly could on Hansen and brought what he had to the state troopers. When the troopers received the file on Hansen, they were very optimistic. All the evidence he brought them made it clear that Robert Hansen was their prime suspect. The problem they were facing was the proof. Because although Hansen was a violent sex offender, his record didn't indicate that he was capable of homicide. And to me, that doesn't say much. Even though they hadn't caught him for murder doesn't mean he hadn't done it. Clearly, he's extremely violent and a very threatening predator, but I digress. But they were looking for a direct link between Hansen and the woman they had found. It was important that they find some kind of link or something more than what Baker had brought them, because they didn't even have enough for a search warrant at that point. All they knew was that three women were dead and 12 were missing. They had a mass murderer on their hands, which was not something Anchorage had experience with. The FBI, however, did. Quantico, Virginia is home to the FBI's Investigative Support Unit. There, agents attempt to predict behavioral patterns by analyzing a criminal's actions. They created profiles for these killers. To create this profile, the FBI only needed facts about the case, no theories. And from there, they created an extremely accurate profile on Robert Hansen, or on this killer. But like I said, they didn't know about Robert Hansen because they only wanted facts. So it said the killer would be an avid outdoorsman and experienced hunter and would have committed arson and theft throughout his life. Since he preyed mostly on sex workers and strippers, he most likely had a difficulty talking to women and had low self-esteem and a history of being rejected by women and grew up feeling like an outcast. They also concluded that he would be a well-liked person in the community since he was able to function so well unnoticed. He was probably someone who worked independently, like a business owner, and most likely he would have kept souvenirs from his kills. And if that isn't spot on enough, the craziest part of the profile was they said that this person would most likely have a stutter or a speech defect. And Hansen did. How did they get a stutter out of finding three bodies? That profile is so interesting to me. I would love to know the criteria for creating these profiles and how they do it, because it's on the nose. They hit the nail on the head, down to the stutter. I can't believe it. While the FBI were coming up with this profile, Trooper Wayne Van Clausen didn't want to waste any time. Like Baker, he had a very good feeling that Robert Hansen was their guy, but he needed more information. Criminal records at that time were just becoming computerized, so he didn't have access to all of Hansen's records in Anchorage. So he went to Juneau and collected Hansen's records from the Superior and Supreme Court archives. that was something that really shocked me when I was doing my research, because in my mind, I'm like, okay, these police know that he has this crazy criminal background. Like, he's already been arrested for assault and kidnap and rape and all these things. But no, they didn't know this because he moved after he had served whatever sentence he served, even though it was really short. So it was technically in his records, but they had to really search for it to find it. So through his research, Van Claussen found every town that Hansen had ever lived in and found criminal records dating back all the way to 1961. He gathered anything he could carry and sent the rest by truck and headed home. Because, again, these are boxes full of records. Like, he had to bring as much as he could carry and then send the rest by car because he couldn't possibly carry all of them. It's just so crazy. I mean, thank God for computers, you know? Because that sounds like a drag. But this whole situation is so, like, detective in a serial killer movie, because the case was suspended, the detective's not supposed to be working on it, but he's working on it in secret even though he's risking his job. They go and find all the records late at night in the archives. They have to carry out boxes of papers. The guy is just this really unassuming baker, but he's doing all these really heinous, terrifying things in reality. I mean, it makes complete sense to me why this was made into a movie, because it sounds like the plot of a movie. So anyway, while Van Claussen was in Juneau and finding these records, that was when the FBI completed their profile and sent it to the troopers. And not long after Van Claussen had returned with his findings, they learned that Hansen had spent 3 years in a reformatory for setting fire to his high school's bus garage, which also lined up with the FBI profile. Hansen's court-ordered psychiatric reports from then also showed that he had low self-confidence, he was really unstable, and had weird sexual fantasies, and he had a stutter. So all the pieces are falling into place, and the troopers are like, okay, he's for sure our guy, but we just need to get enough information on him and enough connections between all of these things so we can really nail him.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus plans November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
One of his earliest victims was a 17-year-old girl who was abducted from outside a coffee shop, and he took her to a cabin in the wilderness where he sexually assaulted her at gunpoint. She actually survived as well, but she did choose to be anonymous throughout this case, so I don't know her name. She said Hansen told her if she went to the police, he would track her down and kill her. He said he was a fine, upstanding businessman, and she would just be a kid that nobody would believe. Same thing he told Cindy Paulson. But it further proves that the FBI profile was right, because he was passing as an innocent and kind local businessman. As troopers zeroed in on Hansen, they decided they should spread out along the Kinnick River area to search for more bodies. They believe the dancers who were still missing may have been buried around where the other bodies were found. But that search unfortunately came up empty. The area was too large and remote to cover completely. Despite the profile and the past police records, troopers didn't have anything tangible to link Hansen to the murders. His police records were too stale, and the evidence was too circumstantial to hold any real weight in a court of law. So investigators hoped that Cindy Paulson would give them something, since she was the only survivor of Hansen they knew of at that time, and his most recent one. They hoped she could remember something new, and luckily for police, she was able to ID one of the guns Hansen had in his possession. But still, that wasn't enough, so they searched for another woman who had survived an attack from Hansen, and like I said, it was that 17-year-old who had been abducted from the coffee shop. She didn't live in the area, and it had been years since her attack. However, troopers reached out, hoping she could give them some new information. They explained to her that they believed he had killed 7 women and asked if she wanted to help convict him, so she did agree to testify when the time came. But even still, investigators had a weak case, and according to Officer Greg Baker, Robert Hansen knew the police were on to him, at least in some capacity. Baker had dropped by the bakery to get some donuts, and Hansen was there. And he had a window where he would stand at the front of the bakery where he decorated cupcakes and cookies. And Baker was watching him for a while. and could tell that Hansen was quite nervous. Hansen kept looking outside at him and kept getting frosting on his thumb as he decorated. And that gave Baker some real satisfaction because it's clear that they're zeroing in on him and he knows it and he's a little bit nervous, so that must have been a good feeling. Because Hansen matched the profile so perfectly, FBI agent John Douglas, who had created the profile, flew to Alaska to review everything and brief the investigators and prosecutor on how to proceed with this suspect. And he was certain that Hansen was their guy. His idea was to bring Hansen in for questioning while simultaneously searching his house. But to get a search warrant, they had to list specific items they believed would be in his house. They knew to look for the gun that Cindy Paulson had ID'd, along with the one that had fired the bullets around the graves of Sherry Morrow and Paula Golding. But even still, they needed a home run, something that would prove Hansen's guilt beyond a shadow of a doubt. So they asked Agent Douglas if there was anything else they should list in the warrant, and he told them yes, he should list the serial killer trophies, something that belonged to the victims, anything from a piece of jewelry to a driver's license, it could really be anything. But they weren't sure if they'd get a warrant because a behavioral profile had never been used as the basis of a search warrant in the US before. They knew they had to back it up with more conventional information. They needed this affidavit to be bulletproof. The last thing they needed was for something to be wrong with the search warrant and then have all of their evidence thrown out in court. So the affidavit ended up being 48 pages, and the judge granted 8 search warrants for Hansen's property. So that was good, but now they just needed Hansen and to find the evidence. At that point, they learned his patterns and knew his schedule. So on October 23rd, 1983, they waited outside his bakery to pick him up. But Hansen didn't show up when they thought he would. He had just gotten a late start, so he kept the officers on their toes. But he eventually pulled up, and they immediately brought him in for questioning. He didn't resist at all. The interrogation room they brought him into was staged to a T. And again, it's like something out of a movie. Agent Douglas had helped the officers to stage the interrogation room for the biggest psychological impact they could have on Hansen. So the room was set up with photos of all the women they suspected he killed, along with crime scene photos, a map of the area around the wilderness of Anchorage, and other related material that Hansen got to sit with for a little while and stare at before the interview began. They were hoping to get a confession out of him and avoid a lengthy legal battle, because if they get a confession from him, then they don't have to work so hard. And the moment the state troopers entered the room, the mind games began, because not only did Douglas show them how to stage the room, but he told them how to play it. They were going to ask him questions in a way that would prompt more discussion and get him to talk specifically. Hansen knew they had access to his psychological and criminal records, so he told them basically what he knew they already had access to. He spoke of his painful upbringing, his strict family, his anger. He admitted to picking up dancers and sex workers in the 70s, and how angry he became when they tried to raise their prices. But he denied threatening any of them, so he didn't confess at all. At the exact same time, troopers rolled up to Hansen's home and served the search warrants to his wife. The troopers were extra cautious and videotaped the entire search. They weren't exactly sure what they were looking for other than the guns. The souvenirs could have been anywhere or really anything. They could have even been in plain sight. Meanwhile, other troopers searched the bakery and his plane, and both were clean. The house became the focal point of the investigation, and finally, in his bedroom, they came upon a box that had been hidden in the headboard of his bed. And inside, they found a map of the region that had 37 X's, which seemed to be clustered around the area where the bodies had been found. So a marked-up map with X's all over it, hidden in his headboard. Really eerie stuff. There were dozens more marks than bodies that they knew of. So they have a moment where they're thinking, are these 37 X's all bodies? It was a very high possibility. They also found more weapons in the attic, hidden under some insulation. They found a .223 Ruger Mini 14 rifle, like the one used to kill Sherry Morrow and Paula Golding, so that was great. And they found a wood-handled revolver, which Cindy Paulson said was the weapon he used on her. As troopers collected the evidence, Hansen's neighbor stopped one of them curious about the activity at the house, and she was stunned by this news. We love a nosy neighbor. And it actually worked out for the investigation. She wasn't just a nosy neighbor because she made a confession to troopers that they were not expecting. She said that her husband had provided Hansen with a false alibi on the night of Cindy Paulson's abduction. She said he had lied, not knowing how serious Hansen's charges actually were. They had no idea, so she immediately was like, oh my God, that was false. The husband later called police and retracted his statement, which meant Hansen's alibi was gone. After that, the troopers found the most incriminating evidence by far. They found his stash of trophies. Not his hunting trophies, his killing trophies. They found a baggie with Sherry Morrow's necklace along with other belongings of dead or missing women. Which is basically case closed at that point. It was good news for the investigators, but heartbreaking in general. Investigators called the station and let their partners know what they had found. Meanwhile, they still had Hansen in the interrogation room. He wouldn't confess, but they at least had enough to lock him up on the Cindy Paulson case. So his bail was set at $500,000, and investigators had time to build their case against him. They called the prior victim to see if she was still on board to testify, since they felt they might really need her as a witness. And she agreed. And on the map they found with the X's, three of them matched up with the locations of the bodies that they had found in the wilderness. Other X's matched up with the locations of a body recovered by Seward police years earlier, and other X's were believed to be graves of more victims. It would have been dozens more. And as far as they were concerned, that was a body count. The troopers believed they had enough evidence to convict Hansen on at least four murders, which was when they approached Hansen and his lawyer with the evidence they had found. And at that point, Hansen couldn't deny what was in front of him. So finally, it was time for a confession. And for Hansen, he was trying to cut a deal. Hansen said he would confess to the murders that they could prove as long as the trial was given no publicity and his family was left alone. And he demanded to be imprisoned outside of Alaska when the trial was over. That was weird to me, that he cares about his family. But I guess there's that. I don't know. It's confusing. So in exchange for four convictions, he agreed to show troopers where more bodies were buried. Investigators called Hansen's anonymous survivor and told her that he was going to confess so they wouldn't need her testimony after all. In an interview she did about that moment that she learned that she wasn't going to have to testify, she said she, quote, hung up the phone when we were done talking, got my son off to school, got my husband out the door, and proceeded to fall apart. I started crying. I couldn't stop. I had no control over it. It controlled me. I could see each and every one of those women, how they died, probably hunted down like dogs, wounded and then hunted more. That was such a heartbreaking quote to me because it's so clear how much that attack affected her, as it of course would, but it also shows her strength because she said, I got my son off to school, I got my husband out the door, and then I broke down. Which was just impactful to me. And I'm glad she didn't have to testify and relive that moment on the stand because that's a nightmare for everyone involved. But he did confess. As a part of his confession, Hansen said that he would take women into the woods and hunt them as prey. Over the dozen years he lived in Alaska, he had sexually assaulted more than 30 women and developed many strategies for catching them. Once he found a target, he would befriend her and arrange to meet her at a fast food place. If they were dancers or aspiring models, he would offer to pay to photograph them. He'd arrive early and wait to make sure that the women were alone and that nobody was waiting for them out in the parking lot, and there would be no witnesses. And then he would go in and meet his new victim. One half of the handcuff was already fastened to his passenger side seat in his car, so when they would get in, he would reach over them and handcuff them to the door very quickly and then reach for his gun. He did it so many times it became like a reflex. He would then take them home or to a remote motel to torture them. He'd blindfold them and bring them out to the outskirts of town, either driving or by plane, until he got to a secluded enough spot where he could hunt these women like prey. In the summer of 83, he devised what he called his summer plan. He sent his family away so he could bring his victims home, and when he was done with them, he would dispose of them in the wilderness. It's an absolute nightmare. I can't even wrap my mind around the fear that these women would be feeling in those moments. I mean, I don't even want to put my mind there because that's awful. But he was a true dangerous predator and treated these women like animals. It's horrifying. On February 27th, 1984, Robert Hansen was convicted of murdering four women and was sentenced to 461 years plus life with no chance of parole. So at least there was that. He was not getting out of prison, and thank goodness for that, because his track record previously showed that he didn't spend a lot of time in prison for what he did. After his sentencing, Hansen accompanied troopers into the wilderness to point out more victims, and in total, 8 bodies were recovered. Some places on the map went unexplored, while some bodies had been lost to scavengers in the woods. Investigators will never know for sure how many of the 37 exes were actually Hansen's victims, but I think it's pretty safe to assume that they most likely all were. According to FBI agent John Douglas, the map may have only depicted a small part of his hunting grounds, so it's possible the number is even higher than 37. Since then, Cindy Paulson has maintained a private life. She did share her life story with actress Vanessa Hutchins, who played her in the movie Frozen Ground, starring Nicolas Cage. Hutchins has said of her conversations with Paulson, "She gave me an extremely solid foundation and told me her earliest memories that she had until where she is to this day. Being able to take those and meditate on them myself and make her memories my own memories put me in the right headspace. It became very accessible to me." According to the Cinemaholic, the director of the film, quote, "respectfully followed everything Paulson expected from him and even received a letter afterward in which Cindy confessed that she felt like a weight had been lifted." And I'm really glad to hear that. I'm glad that the maker of this movie was respectful and they clearly involved her in the making of it and she felt good about it. At least it seems that way. Little is publicly known about the life of Paulson. But according to an article I read in 2013, when the movie came out, she was married with 3 children. So I hope she is doing well. I think we can all agree on that. But that is the story of Cindy Paulson and how she escaped and survived Robert Hansen, who is also known as the Butcher Baker. Whew, that's a dark one. That was a tough story. And I have seen Frozen Ground with Nicolas Cage and Vanessa Hutchins. And it's been a while, but I do remember enjoying the movie. I do think it was a good movie. So if you're interested, check that out. But yeah, I think I've said all I needed to say about Robert Hansen. I mean, there isn't much else to say about how terrible he was and how heartbreaking it is to however many women he actually murdered. It's terrifying to think about the fact that police don't actually know how many it truly was. And even though the map gave a pretty clear number of 37, like, the FBI agent made it pretty clear that, like, that could have just been this one area. So, really scary to think about. But that's really all I have to say about that story. Why don't we move on to something a little bit lighter, and we can leave off on a palate cleanser, and I'll tell you my good thing. So, on the day that I'm recording this, the following day, I'm gonna be moving. With Alex. He's coming too. We're staying in Michigan, but we're headed to a new place, and I'm really excited. I can't wait to get in there. And I talked about this when we were moving from LA to Michigan, but I love interior design. I love interior decorating and all the decor and whatever. And I can't wait to get my grubby little fingers on a new place so I can set it up exactly how I like. And we have a lot of plans, at least I do. I've been Pinteresting like a fiend. So I'm very excited. And even though moving is a stressful task, nothing is quite as stressful as moving across the country. So moving within a state instead of going state to state is a lot better. I will say that. So it feels a lot less stressful than the last move, which is why I'm kind of like, it'll be fine. I'm just mostly excited to get in there and you know, do our thing. So that's what we're going to be doing this weekend. And yeah, I hope you all have a good week ahead of you, or weekend, or morning, or night, or whenever you're listening to this. Thank you for being here. Oh, and before I sign out, our merch is only going to be available for a limited time, so if you have been wanting to get a sweatshirt or a tote bag or a hat or something, head over to nottodaypodcast.myshopify.com and grab yourself something before it goes away. Our merch will come back at some point, but I don't know exactly when, so if you're interested, head over there and grab yourself something. But anyway, If you would like access to a bunch of bonus episodes and vote on stories you want to hear, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a crazy story that you'd like to share with us and possibly hear on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We post pictures over on Instagram @nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the T on the end of podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.